Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Rhetoric and ideology, this week on Soundings. My guest is Daniel Gunn of the University of Maine at Farmington. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Daniel Gunn worked on a study entitled Ideological Rhetoric in the English Novel, 1748 through 1910. Dan Gunn, welcome to Soundings. We're going to talk about fiction. We're going to talk about ideology. Let's begin with some definitions. Ideological rhetoric. You may want to break that into what? The two words themselves.
Well, yeah, let's begin with the two words separately. By ideology, I mean a structure of ideas or concepts used by a class to construe all the random material of the world in its own interest. I mean to dissociate my use of the term from the narrowest and most old-fashioned Marxian use, and there are lots of other Marxian uses, in which ideology is always specifically mystifying or false.
Let me just stop you for a minute. What you're doing here is describing these ideologies. You're not necessarily grinding an axe yourself.
Well, I'm not so sure I'd agree with that. One is always standing on ideological ground. In fact,
it's impossible to avoid.
Right. The problem with the kind of narrow, old-fashioned Marxism that I'm talking about is that it assumes that ideology is what they have and we don't, right? It's the false consciousness of the mystifiers, whereas we are in touch with real history or the truth. And I want to stress again that there are a variety of Marxian uses of the term, and the contemporary Marxist critics like Jameson and Eagleton have elaborated the notion I've been trying to put aside with far more subtlety and sophistication than what I'm assigning to it.
All right, what about the word rhetoric?
Well, by rhetoric, I just mean discourse which is designed to have some effect on a reader, to persuade in the freshman composition sense, right? The English 101 course is often called writing and rhetoric. I'm conscious of owing something in my use of the term applied to fiction to Wayne Booth's famous study, The Rhetoric of Fiction, in which he argued that whatever else they're trying to do, novels are arranged in order to present a series of norms to readers, to put them forward.
Right? I thought that writers, I sit here wide-eyed, Dan Gunn, and I say to you, I thought that writers abhorred the notion of teaching a message or preaching a lesson, and yet after a fashion, you are telling me that that is an impossibility, that it's impossible not to do that in some fashion or other, either the ideology or the rhetoric or the combination of the two.
Well, that's Booth's argument, that even books which claim to be merely showing, claim to be merely presenting an image of the world without commentary, are actually providing all kinds of commentary toward the reader in order to put forward some moral norm. So when you take those two words and put them together, ideological rhetoric, all I'm trying to argue is that the moral rhetoric of the novel, in particular the kind of Richardsonian novels I have in mind, Austin Elliot, right? That moral rhetoric also has an ideological function. That is, it serves the ends of social groups who are struggling for power.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move to some examples, Dan Gunn. You are looking at the novel. You're moving back, into the 18th century, forward into the 20th century. You have a range of writers from Jane Austen to E.M. Forster, Mrs. Gaskell. Some of these are household names. Some of them are not. Talk to me in specific and concrete terms for a few minutes.
Well, I can give you an example of what I don't mean to be doing, as well as what I do, by talking about Jane Austen's Persuasion.
Fair enough.
one thing that criticism in the last 20 years has done with Austin's work is recognize that the old view of Gentle Jane somewhere cut off from real politics and history. You know Churchill's famous comment about her, what calm lives these people had, right? No fears of the Napoleonic Wars. Right? Uh-huh. That's false. Right? That in fact, it's an artificial separation of her novels from the social and political history in which they're actually involved.
She was deeply embroiled.
Right. Uh-huh. So if you take Persuasion, for example, in which the heroine's father, Sir Walter Elliot, who is a baronet, is bankrupt, is running out of money, and he has to move to Bath and rent his manorial estate, whereas there are other characters who are naval officers who are full of energy, who go out and capture prizes on the open sea. And it's clear that Austin prefers the latter. Her heroine eventually marries someone from that group. So one way to try and re-embed that in social and political history would be to say, okay, Sir Walter Elliot, this down on his luck baronet, represents the aristocracy, represents some older landed class, whereas Frederick Wentworth, the naval officer, represents the rising bourgeoisie, the rising money. You know, that's one of the things that's always happening. The middle class is always rising.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with that is it turns the fiction into a kind of allegory, where mm-hmm. it merely reflects either real social history or in a more sophisticated version, some utopian wish on the part of the author about
right.
social history.
And I take it that you want what to qualify, amplify that use that as a departure point.
Right. What I want to say is that's too simple.
Uh-huh.
And if you use ideology as a mediating term, mm-hmm. you can see the work as actually embedded in history without merely being reflection, because a book like Persuasion doesn't just reflect the social world, it actually participates in the social world. That is, it tries to communicate a kind of morality toward young women readers, for example, by the way it describes the moral dilemma of its heroine, Anne Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the way to re-embed the work in the social world, is by looking at that morality and saying, how is that ideological? How does that represent the interests of either the Wentworth group or the Sir Walter Elliot group?
Again, I'll be sort of wide-eyed, Dan Gunn. Isn't it a bit of a stretch, really, after all is said and done, to, in a way, reduce these characters, however simply we may wish to do that, to social forces, political or ideological themes? Why can't we read them simply for the enjoyment that they offer to us, with respect toward the imagination of the writer, rather than all of these political and ideological implications? Let me challenge you with that.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a reduction. I'm not arguing this is the only thing that these books do and the only possible way of talking about them. But I'd also want to argue that if we consistently refuse to talk about social and political issues, as the history of literary criticism has done mm-hmm. In this country for 25 or 30 years, then we risk not recognizing the way social forms like the novel condition our thinking. The easiest way for most readers to think of that issue now is to think of the image of women that's portrayed mm-hmm. in standard English novels, for example. It used to be that people would have made your objection to saying anything about the way women characters are portrayed, for example, in Dickens or Mrs. Gaskell. But now it's become very difficult for most readers, men and women, to read an old-fashioned English novel without recognizing that the vision of women in those novels is seriously delimited, proscribed.
Dan Gunn, let me ask you to turn to another example, your description of rhetoric and ideology. You're writing about Mary Barton, a novel which appears, an English novel, which appears around the middle of the 19th century. Why is it ideological?
Well, let me give you an extended example from the end of that novel, which appeared in 1848, as you say, right around the middle of the century. The central incident of the novel is a political murder.
Hmm.
And at the end of the novel, the father of the victim, on his way home from having recognized the murderer, sees an incident in the streets, which seems clearly meant by Gaskell to be a transformation of the murder itself. There's a young, middle-class girl dressed as if she's just been to a dance, tripping along to some music that she's heard, and she's knocked down by a rude errand boy who's described in exactly the same terms that the workers in the novel are often described in. When the girl's nurse picks up the errand boy and says she's going to grab him to take him to the police, the young girl says, "He didn't know what he was doing, nurse." And she has blood on her dress, right? I mean, drops of blood, which are meant to mirror the murder. She said, he didn't know what he was doing, nurse. Please forgive him.
Echoing the words of Christ in the New Testament.
Exactly. And the victim's father, whose name is John Carson, thinks of those words, which also echo something that John Barton has just said to him, the murderer has just said to him. And he goes home and takes his Bible off the shelf and learns forgiveness.
And now you say that this is a deflected ideology. What do you mean by that?
Well, let me say first that I think it's clearly part of the moral rhetoric of the novel. That is, she's trying to get us to see forgiveness as a proper response to this kind of political violence. And in fact, that's part of the larger moral structure of the novel. She's trying to suggest that the proper middle-class response to working people is a more human Christian response at a personal level. Now, well, it's a deflection, I think, in several respects. One of them is that the victim is changed from a young man into a young girl. And all the way through the novel, the kinds of responses that Gaskell sees as appropriate are what she would imagine as female, almost maternal responses. Well, that's part of a long tradition in the English novel of taking morality and funneling it into a female ghetto.
Well, it sounds like Dickens, for example. You find a lot of characters in his fiction. Are we on the right track there?
Absolutely. It's also true of other industrial novels that the political plot is often funneled into a domestic plot where the morality becomes a woman's concern and where orthodox feminine behavior, self-denying and altruistic and nurturing, can somehow resolve the larger social issue.
You're telling me, in short, Dan Gunn, that what we're doing is finally recognizing in the evidence of the novels an important issue that was there all along, namely a woman's issue, if not necessarily a feminine perspective, something that needs to come to the surface.
Well, but I don't think that Mrs. Gaskell's position is finally one that feminists would applaud or is a position that's helpful for women. Because first of all, domestic goodness cannot resolve large questions of the distribution of material resources. It's a kind of feint. That's what I meant by a deflection.
I see.
And second, it puts a kind of pressure on women characters, an ideological burden, if you like, that they have to carry all the moral weight of society, that it becomes moral questions all become questions that have to do with domestic life and with women, and not with, even in novels where they're especially actually invoked in the world of business and manufacturing, moral questions are moved out of that sphere and back into the domestic sphere.
You make me think of the death scenes in Harriet Beecher Stowe and, again, the novels of Charles Dickens. Dan Gunn, why is this kind of literary criticism important in the 1980s? Is there anything peculiar to our time that brings forth this combination of ideology and rhetoric?
Well, that's a very good and large question. It's important personally for me, and I think for some other modern readers and critics, because so much of what we were taught about literature as undergraduates, say, was completely separated and divorced from social and political history, so that one imagined literature and literary form as in some special platonic zone where the forms were off by themselves having tea, and where things were changing, forms evolving from one into another without ever being connected with anything outside.
You remind me of a book that I used as an undergraduate called Understanding Literature, edited by a man named Walter Blair, and we had sections roughly as follows: theme, character, setting. I see what you mean by this Platonic other world. Now, so where is it today? I mean, by contrast, what's going on now?
Well, these themes that you mentioned as well can all be applied to any work of literature, right? From the 18th century through the 20th century.
The universal.
Right, as if they all were in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's been a reaction against that in general.
Right. Right?
That my personal trajectory matches the trajectory of a lot of other students of literature in wanting somehow to find some way of talking about literature which would not savage the form, which would not reduce it to crudities,
mm-hmm.
but would also find some way to connect it with history.
Does this make of you, Dan Gunn, a child of the 60s? Are you a sort of mellowing radical here in your late 30s, early 40s, carrying with you into the literary explorations that you conduct some of that passion that that we saw in our society 20, 25 years ago?
I have no idea. I've seen such arguments in print,
right.
That is attempts to explain what's called the new historicism, which
right.
is where a lot of this kind of criticism is lumped. By biographical reasons, the aging of those who were undergraduates in the 60s and 70s. It's possible also that it's simply a reaction in terms connected almost with production. One of the things that criticism is a kind of business or enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And if one takes an extremely cynical view, the purely formalist readings were running out of gas, and one and one needed a new rubric to generate more readings. I hope that's not the case.
What about our own time, our own political and ideological circumstances here in the late 1980s, providing a context for this type of literary investigation, rhetoric and ideology?
One possible context is that living in a culture like ours, we have unprecedented freedom of discourse
mm-hmm.
without having much power in the way of effecting any change with that discourse. So in a university, for example, it sometimes seems as if one can say anything one wants,
right.
but nothing changes. No response is felt. That suggests a very heavy degree of ideological control, a very heavy degree of containment in contemporary cultural discourse. So it seems natural that critics want to go back and look at the history of containment, mm-hmm. ideological containment in discourse, and recognize the ways in which ideology has an effect on readers, even in a fairly innocent, what seems like an innocent form, like
mm-hmm.
the novel.
Well, I'll invite you to avoid the pitfalls of self-congratulation or self-serving in your own criticism here. Is this healthy stuff that's going on, looking for these, investigating these connections between ideology and the rhetoric in which it is embedded, to use your term?
I think it's very healthy, because the kinds of discourse associated with the new criticism and Brooks and Warren, what you were talking about before, are not non-ideological. They have an ideological effect themselves in preventing us from considering moral and economic questions. They mask the moral and economic issues that are at work in literature. So it seems to me healthy to recognize that, to no longer let these issues be masked, and to try and actually look at what literature really, really does. I think there's a cost, too.
What do you have in mind?
Well, one's impulse, especially as an undergraduate, is to fall at the feet of the great writer.
Mm-hmm. It's on the page. It's there in print.
Well, not even that. I mean, most of us got involved in literature because it had some deep personal effect on it. I mean, I read Jane Austen, for example, for the first time and thought, this is a higher morality than anything I've ever been exposed to. This is this is a teacher, mm-hmm. right, for how I ought to live my life. I felt the same way reading Wordsworth. Right? But the kind of criticism I'm engaged in now necessarily produces a kind of distance between the reader and the literary work. In fact, I think that's a feature of a lot of historical criticism. If, in fact, it's an ideologically conditioned statement made at a particular time, then we can't simply assume that it's trans-historically appropriate mm-hmm. for us. And we also have to recognize that it guides and forces us into a corner even as we're reading it.
It's a commonplace, Dan Gunn, that we moved from occupations, preoccupations that focused on the sacred into the secular as we look at the arc of literary history. You're telling me that we're secularizing the secular.
I think that's exactly right. If you recognize the degree to which what you're calling secular mm-hmm. has become almost religious in the discourse of literary criticism, so someone like Austin or George Eliot takes on the status of a divinity mm-hmm. and then needs to be secularized. And there's what I started out saying is that there's a cost to that, to losing one's gods, if you like, or goddesses.
Dan Gunn, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation about literature, rhetoric, and ideology. We have a big debate going on in both academic and popular circles these days about what we call the canon, our sort of received, inherited wisdom of the West, you know, that sort of thing. I'd like you to consider that as an issue that is involved here in your project. And then in more specific terms, tell me how you picked the books that you discuss in this project.
Okay, well, picking the novels that I chose for my study, I actually wasn't attempting to redefine the canon or consider the question of canon formation. It's in fact important for my purposes that these be standard canonical works mm-hmm. which had some effect on an audience and some influence on literary history. There also were peculiar themes that come up in all of the novels I chose and my own idiosyncrasies that led to the choice. But I do think that my project is related to the issues that you're talking about. And my sympathies are with the people at Stanford University, for example, who redesigned their core curriculum in order to incorporate more Third World and Black and mm-hmm. female writers into the kinds of texts which freshmen are being asked to read. Because one motivation for such reform, I think, is a recognition that literature is ideological, mm-hmm. a recognition that in reading books only by white, male, Western European and American writers.
Dooms, they're called. Dead European white males.
Right, dead white guys. we are making a statement about what's important, about what the central issues and concerns of our culture are. That they're not mm-hmm. purely innocent texts at whose feet we can throw ourselves, that they are having some effect on the college freshmen who read them, that they are putting forward a kind of ideological rhetoric of their own. And what I think those who wish to reform the canon are trying to do is to add other voices. I don't think this means that we're left with a complete leveling. Right? We right. are part of a community, an academic community, even in a place like Stanford or at my university. Can make its own decisions about what good writing is, about what kinds of voices are important to be heard, without simply wiping out all hierarchical distinctions.
All right. Well, what about the after effects of these individual, rather communal choices? We live in a society that has to cohere. One of the ways in which it's supposed to cohere is in terms of what educational standards that we can judge more or less to be more or less consistent and even throughout the population. That's what all the bellyaching is about, that some kids can't read, some kids can't write. We don't have this central set of concerns. Do we have a necessary opposition in this polarity?
I don't think so. I think everyone needs to be able to read and write. Mm-hmm. You can't understand any of the texts we're talking about if you can't read critically and write and think about them. But I don't think it's necessarily true that we have to have a standard set of 10 books which all college freshmen have read. Mm-hmm. I think we ought to hope that college freshmen develop critical reading skills which make them able to make sense of a wide range of texts, and that they have some acquaintance with kinds of literature, right?
So it's not so much what they've read as the ability to think critically about what they read.
And I think it's, yes, and in order to generate that kind of critical thinking, it's important to respond to some texts which come out from outside of one's own contemporary culture, right? Uh-huh. So I think, for example, reading Paradise Lost or some such text which has the kind of weight and substance and historical distance that Paradise Lost has, it is crucial, is important. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to me necessary that every college freshman should have read Paradise Lost or any other text. We simply don't have enough time in our educational process to come up with a standard list of texts and have everybody have read them.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Daniel Gunn of the University of Maine at Farmington. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Daniel Gunn worked on a study entitled Ideological Rhetoric in the English Novel. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 448. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about law, literature, and public opinion during the French Revolution. My guest will be Sarah Mazza of Northwestern University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in April and the first week in May mark birthdays for the American inventor Samuel Morse, the newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst, the labor leader Mary Harris Jones, the singer Kate Smith, and the women's rights advocate Nellie Bly. Morse was born in 1791, Hearst in 1863, Mother Jones in 1830, Kate Smith in 1909, and Nellie Bly in 1867. Late April and early May are also the anniversary of the Mutiny on the Bounty, which occurred when Fletcher Christian rebelled against William Bly in 1789. Finally, the first successful flight by a woman from England to Australia began in early May 1930. The pilot was Amy Johnson, who came to be known later as the Wonder Girl of the Air. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Rhetoric and Ideology, this week on Soundings. Listen for Daniel Gunn of the University of Maine at Farmington. Daniel Gunn is working on a study of the English novel from the 18th through the 20th centuries. How do novelists express ideology? What are the effects of these ideological expressions upon readers? Rhetoric and Ideology, some answers and insights, this week on Soundings.